Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nature Bats Last. I'm Pauline Schneider, coming to you from Pleasantville, New York, via the Progressive Radio Network, PRN-FM. This is a pre-recorded show, so I won't be able to take any calls, but please feel free to comment on the Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM Facebook group page. We will try to monitor it while the show is aired. Tonight, I'm covering for multiple absentee hosts, Dr. Guy McPherson, Mike Sliva, who are both still traveling. Mike is in Europe, and Guy's been lecturing in New Zealand and Australia. Our theme song is provided by Afrizen, A-F-R-I-Z-E-N, and you can find his music on SoundCloud. Our new SOS background sound for News Beyond the Mainstream and our climate summary segment is provided by 17-year-old Rianne Farragan. Thanks, Rianne. Tonight I'll have as my guests two very special women, dear friends of mine and eco-warriors who taught me everything I know about getting arrested while protesting the tar sands pipeline in 2011, Cameron Kelly and Susan Rubin. And now for News Beyond the Mainstream. Although today's topic, Ebola, is mostly in the mainstream, it's all we've been hearing. The undercurrent causes of it remain mysterious, hidden, and unmentioned in the lamestream media. Ebola is a rare disease first discovered in 1976, thought at first as a possible strain of the Marburg virus, but was not. Wikipedia states, Ebola virus is the single member of the species Zaire Ebola virus, which is the type species for the genus Ebola virus, family Phyloviridae, order Mononega viralis. No, I was not a biology major at all, but anyway. Mononega viralis includes several common viruses many of us have personally experienced, like measles and mumps, and includes rabies, and hopefully no one's experienced that. These names, incidentally, are all new, starting with Ebola in 1976 and Mononega viralis, a name created in 1991 and which is constantly being emended. So Ebola effectively never existed before 1976, as far as we can tell. It could be a natural mutation or some kind of military experiment. No one really knows where it came from. Rachel Ratner, senior writer for Live Science, quotes Derek Gather, a bioinformatics researcher at Lancaster University in the United Kingdom, who said in September, quote, "There's a strong circumstantial case, but we haven't actually got a total smoking gun," end quote. Wikipedia says this, "The natural reservoir of Ebola virus is believed to be bats, particularly fruit bats, and it's primarily transmitted between humans and from animals to humans through bodily fluids." And remember, your bodily fluids include semen, saliva, sweat, mucus, blood, etc. And the virus has a long shelf life. Unlike the AIDS virus, it survives long after its victim has died. So please don't sweat on my bench press at the gym. Even though we are assured that virus germs only begin to be shed when the symptoms begin, remember, there is a fine line between the not shedding part and the shedding part when the virus is contagious. The World Health Organization has listed Ebola as a biosafety level 4 pathogen with the highest containment requirements due to the risk of aerosol-transmitted laboratory infections. What else do we know about this virus? Well, this week on PRN's This Can't Be Happening, hosted by Dave Lindorf, the guest was professor and attorney Francis Boyle. Boyle is infamous for winning a war crimes conviction against Bush Jr. and Dick Cheney in Malaysia a few years ago. And Malaysia's been in the news a lot lately, hasn't it, with a couple of missing and blown up airplanes. Boyle was also the person who drafted the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989 in the U.S., which was passed unanimously by both houses. Now, that hasn't happened in a long time. And signed into law by war criminal George W. Bush. This act banned all use of and experimentation of biological weapons. Boyle says he believes this Ebola outbreak is different from any other outbreak, all of which had previously been contained and had about a 50% fatality rate with some rare 90% fatality rates, but always contained. This new outbreak is not being contained, has a 70% fatality rate, and the Independent has said that it has a 75% chance to arrive in the UK and France by the end of October. That's this week. If flight travel were restricted by 80%, the risk would be reduced to between 15 and 25%. 25 countries have already restricted travelers from the stricken countries, and the U.S. is not one of them. It is the Surgeon General who has the power to restrict entry of persons and/or property from countries with dangerous communicable diseases. So let's ask him if he might consider doing something like that. Boyle points out that the fingerprints of the U.S. military are all over this Ebola strain because of where the outbreaks are: Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The U.S. government has three BSL-4, that's biosafety level 4 labs, in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. BSL-4 facilities research biological weapons. Guinea and Liberia are not part of the Biological Weapons Convention, so that's how they were able to do that. Sierra Leone is, but they get around the Anti-Biological Warfare Convention by collaborating with the CDC, which was doing biological work for the Pentagon in Sierra Leone since 1988, allegedly looking for a vaccine for Ebola. In his interview on This Can't Be Happening, Boyle insisted that the Ebola strain has been altered because all preceding Ebola outbreaks had been contained with a 50% fatality rate. This outbreak is not contained and has a 70% fatality rate, so he really believes that it must be genetically modified. Amazingly, the CDC is openly modifying the Ebola virus to combine it, wait for it, with the common cold, with the goal of creating, wait for it, a vaccine. I don't know what's crazier. Even more upsetting, if you're not upset enough, is Boyle's alarm that the World Health Organization said last week that the CDC's 21-day quarantine is not enough. It should be a 42-day quarantine, which is based on the 50% fatality rate. With the current 70% fatality rate, Boyle believes a 50-day quarantine would be the smart choice. He pointed out that the current CDC decision is a cost-benefit analysis and not a health decision. You can hear that whole interview on PRN's This Can't Be Happening from the October 22nd show. Bringing this story home, for me personally, is the newest victim of Ebola, Dr. Craig Spencer, a volunteer for Doctors Without Borders, who returned to New York through JFK Airport on Thursday, and because he showed no symptoms, passed the enhanced screening protocols. This brave man volunteered to go into a situation most of us try to avoid. Unfortunately, even with all his protective gear and training, somehow he still caught the virus, and no one is really sure how. Some suspect he may have contracted it while fraternizing with locals, which leads to the question, how contagious is this thing? And is the virus spread when no symptoms are showing? Big questions. The U.S. has most likely been tinkering with weapons-grade Ebola in the three countries now afflicted with this new strain of Ebola. And instead of sending them doctors, we send soldiers who have no medical training, and they're going to mingle with the locals too. According to David Martosko, U.S. political editor for Mail Online of the Daily Mail, quote, Dr. Spencer rode the subway along with visiting a Brooklyn bowling alley, the Gutter, and the High Line Park. He had also eaten at the meatball shop in Greenwich Village and stopped at Blue Bottle Coffee on the High Line on Tuesday, end quote. And so this brings this home for me because my two eldest children have recently moved to Brooklyn. And I know this story isn't just all about my kids, but, you know, it's kind of personal. So if this doesn't get any more upsetting for everybody, stunningly, Zero Hedge reports with photos to document it that the NYPD, in all its wisdom, sent police officers to check the doctor's apartment. Police officers that did not wear hazmat suits or biosafety level 4 gear. Why? Why would they do that? And when they were done doing whatever they were doing, they disposed of their dust masks and gloves, not in a hazmat bag, but on the street corner bins in one of the busiest cities in the world, where our sanitation workers will come and unwittingly spread Ebola germs on themselves, in their trucks, and into the sewer system and waste stream. This is personal again. My former boyfriend worked for the New York City Department of Sanitation, and I know for a fact that he and his coworkers would not be happy to be exposed by this. Not very professional or smart, Mayor de Blasio. We aren't buying this false sense of security that you and Cuomo are trying to push on us, especially not when our public servants are not taking logical and practical precautions to protect even themselves. Where are the so-called preparations you've been making? Reuters now reports that New York and New Jersey are considering mandatory Ebola quarantine for at-risk travelers, and the governor did pass that. He did make that happen the other day. And a nurse coming in from, I don't know which country, was immediately quarantined, taken against her will, and she threatened to sue, and so they let her go, which, I mean, I don't know. I mean, apparently, the Doctors Without Borders have a system in place, and they know how to quarantine themselves. And in Nigeria, they were able to lock this down, and they allowed the people to quarantine themselves in their homes. They didn't have to be quarantined in some remote location where they had no contact with their family. So, you know, let's talk to the doctors and work with them and figure out a way to do this where we can be humane and not infringe on people's human rights. But the people, everyone needs to be protected. So we need to be smart about this and not be reactive. So Cuomo says he's mulling what to do with the travelers that don't comply with the quarantine. Should we arrest them? Should we prosecute them? He says the law is unclear. However, he's not being entirely forthright because there is the U.S. Code 42 titled The Public Health and Welfare, Chapter 6A, Part G, Quarantine and Inspection, Section D. All right, bear with me, guys. Apprehension and examination of persons reasonably believed to be infected in a qualifying stage. A person who's in a qualifying stage is to be detained because they are A, in a communicable stage, or B, in a pre-communicable stage, if the disease would be likely to cause a public health emergency if transmitted to other individuals, which Ebola would be. But people aren't showing symptoms in a pre-communicable stage, just like the doctor didn't show symptoms or the nurse who just came in. And they went through the JFK gauntlet. He would have qualified to be detained. And I don't know, maybe that would have made sense, considering where he'd come from. But maybe we should be talking with these doctors and work something out that is safe and smart and doesn't dehumanize people. By the way, did you know that you need a whooping cough vaccine or proof that you're immune to enter the U.S.? But, you know, when you're coming from an Ebola-stricken country, well, come on in. We'll quarantine you later. So what's the takeaway from all this? People, we need to take care of ourselves. We need to consider the point where we may want to self-quarantine for 50 days, set aside those provisions to make that possible. Food, water, medications, think of your pets. Kind of like prepping for a hurricane and long-term power outages. This government is not here to help us or guide us. They're like the Three Stooges bumbling around. We need to take care of each other. You are Superman and Superwoman now. It's up to you. I'm Pauline Schneider, and this is Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM Radio. I'm covering for Guy McPherson and Mike Sliva this week. Guy will be back next week. Yay! So I'd like to take a little musical interlude here. The song I'm going to play was featured in the Going Dark documentary in the closing titles. It's written by my daughter, Christina Schneider, when she was 18, nearly 7 years ago, produced by Mary Wood at Frisbee Studios. It's called Stripped. And you can find her in SoundCloud at OSR Tapes as C.E. Schneider. Here she is with Stripped.
The holy process, and death has smelled the life I made. Every stretch of my solemn beauty, caressed by the devil, bled out of this world.
Christina Schneider from the documentary Going Dark. I'm Pauline Schneider, and this is Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM radio, covering tonight for Guy and Mike. Guy returns next week. I'd now like to welcome my two guests, Cameron Kelly and Susan Rubin. And we're actually sitting in Cameron Kelly's living room today, even though this is a pre-recorded session. Please feel free to chat along and comment on the Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM Facebook group page. Susan Rubin is a food and environmental educator and activist. After focusing on school food activism for over a decade, she now spends most of her time growing food with young children at Mount Kisco Child Care Center, blogging and making short films on a variety of topics. Let's say that's a hard word. Cameron Kelly is the owner and operator of her own dance and fitness company and teaches dance classes herself throughout Westchester, New York. Her company also offers many reskilling workshops. She's a mother of three grown daughters, all born at home, and now a grandmother of three. She describes herself as a 9/11 truther, permaculturist, prepper, free-thinking, socialist, feminist activist. Love it. That's what I love about you guys. I met these two warriors through Facebook, so I have Mark Zuckerberg to thank for that.
Definitely, yes.
I'm really happy to have you both here today. Cameron, how is the traffic getting here?
Perfect.
Found a good parking
yes,
spot?
Yes,
yeah, excellent.
Always good.
That's awesome. So you've both been activists for a long time. Was there a tipping point event that propelled you into jumping in, or were you just always conscious, evolved beings? Who wants to go first?
I guess I've always been making a little trouble along the way.
This is Susan answering.
Yeah, Susan. And I guess that really starts with, you know, seeing the garbage that my kids were eating in school. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really able to play inside the sandbox that the PTA set up first. And it's interesting because it wasn't that long ago, but believe it or not, not everybody had email back then.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And so organizing and doing things then was a little different than it is now. But so, yeah, I've always been not afraid to speak out when I see injustice or really bad food.
That's great, because there's a lot of bad food in the schools.
Still, yeah.
They really. I mean, they try. They talk. There's a lot of talk. But, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not too good.
Yeah.
How about you?
Well, I grew up in, you know, the 60s and 70s, and so there was a lot of anti-war
protesting. It was pretty
quiet then.
Everything was quiet.
Yeah. So I was, you know, used to an atmosphere of people demonstrating and protesting and being out in the streets and also trying new things.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in college in University of Oregon, we actually, that's right after I had my daughter. And we occupied the chancellor's office because at that point they were trying to get the universities to divest their funds that were invested in South Africa because apartheid was around then. And so we, of course, were all arrested, and I was the first person to go to trial. And so it was a very eye-opening experience out in Oregon there.
Oh, that's amazing. There's a big divestment movement right now.
Yeah, against Israel.
Yeah. Israel and the fossil fuel industries.
Yeah, that too.
It's huge, yeah.
And, you know, that has some power. Mm-hmm. It hits them in the pocketbook, so it makes a big difference.
It seems to be the most painful place,
mm-hmm.
you know, aside from between the legs.
Yeah.
The pocketbook is a good spot.
Right. Right.
They love their money.
Yeah.
This they do, sometimes more than just about anything else. Yes, it's very true. So, Cameron, the first time I met you, you were giving a presentation on Cuba,
mm-hmm.
and I knew Cuba was beautiful and, you know, had great beaches, but we weren't allowed to go there, and I didn't really know that you could go to Cuba. And you're saying all this amazing stuff. I'm like, I want to go to Cuba,
mm-hmm.
and I just thought that was incredible. What, you know, right now, what can you tell us about Cuba sending all these doctors? They're sending 165 medical personnel to West Africa to help with the Ebola crisis.
Exactly. As you said before, you know, the U.S. government is sending soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and the Cuban government is sending doctors. And they won't be there like Dr. Spencer, who just was there for 1 month, which is the usual tour of duty now, mm-hmm. with volunteers that go from the U.S. They usually have a 6-month commitment when they go to another country. And they've been all over the world. Doctors are sent by Cuba to all kinds of devastated areas, including Haiti. In fact, Cuba offered to send some doctors over when Hurricane Katrina hit, but the U.S. gracefully declined.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, the Cuban doctors go there, and they not only take care of the problem, but they also train.
That's
and
great.
And they help the people that live there to, you know, be able to be responsible for their own health afterwards.
Yeah.
So it's very important, and they're able to do that because they have so many doctors in Cuba, because education in Cuba, including medical school, is free for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Not only all the Cuban people, but they welcome people to come from other countries and go to medical school at the Latin American School of Medicine. And in fact, some U.S. students just graduated 2 years ago, the first batch, and now they're back here working in the United States.
That's genius.
Yeah.
And the school is a great school. It's an amazing medical school. Yeah.
But all education is free.
Right.
All medical care in Cuba is free.
Fantastic.
All, you know, dental care, free. all classes.
So
free.
When can we move there?
Well, we can't even go there right now because the United States does not allow travel to Cuba except under very restricted circumstances right now. Called people-to-people programs. But, our government doesn't allow travel to Cuba for its citizens, even though we know we're free. We can go wherever we want. But we can't go to Cuba. I don't know why.
I think that's new. That's pretty new.
No, it's not new.
My sister was just there this past summer.
Oh, no.
My friend's son went there in last January as a tourist
with some sort of a program. Then he went there.
No, he went alone. Sister is a professor. She went with a group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's got to be an educational thing.
Yeah, it's got to be an educational thing. Yeah. But also, you know, we have a 50-year now blockade against Cuba, an economic blockade.
Yeah.
So we don't allow trade with Cuba, nor do we now allow any of our allied countries to trade with Cuba, like, for example, Mexico, nor do we allow any companies in Europe that are allied with U.S. corporations to trade with Cuba. Mm-hmm. So it's a blockade that we have against them. Mm-hmm. So I would like to see the blockade ended, and I would like to see Cuba just be able to exist and kind of see what happens to a country that runs under, you know, a socialist economic system.
Right.
I'd like to see what really happens to that country if they can make a go of it with socialism as an alternative to our capitalist system.
Right.
Or would the corporations invade and we'd have tacky high-rises all over the beaches?
Possibly.
Right.
And why are there still refugees?
Right, right.
Why are there still refugees from the country?
From Cuba?
Yeah.
Well, there's refugees from all countries that go to other countries.
No, I mean, it's another wave like there was several years ago. And I'm not quite sure because when I speak to more progressive type people like yourself and my sister, it's a fabulous place to live.
Well, you know, the Cuban people see the American dream in the movies and TV programs. And just like people from all over the world, they come here thinking that they'll be able to become one of those millionaire types that, you know, that everyone here believes that they'll someday be able to be. And the reality, the harsh reality, is that living in this country is very hard for many people.
75% of people believe they're going to be millionaires, and so they vote that way. Did you know that? A study was done?
That's great.
Yes, 75% of people believe. Meanwhile, we all are part of the 99. That's 99% are not ever going to be part of the 1%.
Right.
Or maybe we fall in, we fall out, you know, but no, 75% are not, are confused. But that's amazing about Cuba. And I think it's worth people to look into their medical system and maybe we could learn from that.
And also the fact that they do an amazing job with their urban agriculture.
Yeah. I was just going to say, they have better food
because
they have these circles around cities where they grow organic
green belts.
And they also, they don't use petrochemical fertilizers. They use worm compost.
Right.
And they have these giant hundreds and hundreds of giant wormeries where they actually transform their food scraps into rocket fuel, really good soil amendment that makes for healthier food. So it's really interesting. I would venture to say their healthcare system and their food system is a little more advanced than ours.
Well, and they're using permaculture. I mean, they called, you know, the permaculture geniuses from Australia to come in and help them.
Right.
In the 90s.
Yeah, when the USSR collapsed and couldn't send them petroleum anymore. Or petroleum-made products, so they had to figure it out fast.
So all throughout Havana, all vacant lots have been turned now to food production.
That's great.
With raised beds. And it's also labor-intensive a little bit, so it's provided jobs for lots of people that live in the cities, which has been very helpful. And then the food that's grown is used in the neighborhoods right nearby. All of the hospitals in Cuba, prisons, schools, universities all have their own gardens and grow their own food, unlike here, where all of the schools, prisons, hospitals are all contracted with the big agri companies.
They're actually not allowed to.
Exactly.
Corporate food. That's the way. That's because we have capitalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, food has got to turn a profit in the schools. It's got to either break even or turn a profit.
Right.
And so that goes against, you know, my bottom line as a parent, you know, I want my kids to be healthy. And but meanwhile, Aramark, which runs most of the school cafeterias here in Westchester, their bottom line is to deliver a profit to their shareholders. So it's a real conflict of interest.
Definitely. Yes, so Susan, speaking of conflicts of interest. You recently made an amazing little documentary. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I've been toying around making short films for a while. I made one on backyard chickens, and I made one about garbage. And my fellow filmmaker, Andrea, and I, we have been, you know, we live about 11 miles away from the Indian Point nuclear power plant, which is a 40-plus-year-old plant currently operating without a license. But so there's these bus stops all over here in northern Westchester, little blue and white bus stops. It says nuclear evacuation bus stop. So we thought, oh my gosh, this is like crazy. So we made a short little movie about what we thought was going to be the bus stops, but we ended up making a movie about the plan, which is the evacuation plan for 300,000 people around in the 10-mile radius. And
10 mile radius.
Yeah. So I live 10.5 miles away. And so apparently the radiation is going to magically stop.
That's what isotopes do, I hear.
Yeah.
They just stop at this point at like a 10 mile.
There's no plan.
And they just wait there.
There's no plan for us. And there's 20 million of us that live within a 50 mile radius. But so I tried to make it kind of lighthearted, like a comedy. I reached out to Ralph Nader, who literally called me back like 4 hours later and said, I'm in, how can I help you?
That's great.
And then we actually staged a mock nuclear evacuation, which was kind of fun to do.
It's awesome. So, I think a lot of the listeners have watched it already.
Oh, good.
I posted it last night, so it's part of their homework.
There you go. Very nice. Very nice. Right now we're you know, popping around at little film festivals. We're at the Woodstock Museum Film Festival a couple months ago. And now we are up for an award for best writing at the New York Short Film Festival.
That's
which
great.
I think is next month. And then there's the Uranium Film Festival.
Oh, God.
Which is an international film festival. And I think this one's last year it was in Rio. I think this year it's in Berlin.
Oh, wow.
So they really want us. So we'll see. It's
perfect.
But, you know, I made it like short, sweet, accessible. It's on Vimeo.
It's fantastic.
And, yeah. So.
Yeah, I love. Can you tell us any about the little ending? The guy has that little cryptic thing, which is really funny.
I know. Yeah. So we were just like going around to coffee shops and asking people, you know, doing like a woman on the street, you know, interview. And so I asked, you know, I was just asking people, and this one guy said, well, I'm going to take the tunnel. And I said, what tunnel? So, well, the tunnels that they must have built, you know? So
that's so, really, yeah.
And
that's
we
priceless.
Did premiere this film at the NRC public meeting in Cortlandt Manor, New York, last year under duress from the NRC. They really wanted it to be screened at the end of the meeting. And a young Japanese gal named Yuko actually went up on the stage, took over the laptop, and screened the movie while everyone in the audience was like, show the film, show the film.
Wow.
And it's while so this funny. Was going on, I was running around handing out little red and white boxes of popcorn. Which is really fun.
Great.
And, you know, I was like, it's a short movie. Here, have a little bit
little
of popcorn.
Little tiny.
except for the fellows in Indian Point that work in Indian Point, they wouldn't take my popcorn.
Mm. Oh, why? Did they think it wasn't radioactive?
I don't know.
they want the radiation with their popcorn.
But anyway, that's kind of my approach to things is have a little fun while doing this. And so, yeah, that was our world premiere at the NRC meeting.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I should have had you up there to film.
I would have loved it.
That.
Nobody got it?
No.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah,
you need that.
Yeah. I don't know if they would have let you in. I mean, there were literally, like,
journalists?
State troopers at the door.
Yeah, if you're a journalist. Wouldn't they let a journalist in?
I have no idea.
No, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't live too much further than you from the evacuation route. But I used to live in Ossining, which was in the evacuation zone. And I remember hearing, you know, the sirens, the practice test,
yeah.
Once a month on Tuesdays, I think it was back then. And every time I'd hear it, I'd sit down and write a poem. That's not the sirens, people. No. I don't know if you can hear it. But in the background, we're hearing the fire horn. The fire horn blew a little while ago, a 5-alarm fire. So there's some trouble going on somewhere out there. Yeah. Wish them luck. I hope they're okay. But hearing those sirens, it's very creepy.
Right. It's and you don't even chilling. Know if you're not paying attention if all is the real deal. Yeah,
exactly.
Or what. But, exactly. You know, there's social justice piece connected to this is huge, which we don't really talk about is, you know what? Most people who have money here in Westchester County, they're going to get in their car and go. Who doesn't have a car? People of low income.
Right, right.
People who are struggling to make ends meet. Yeah.
People who ride the bus.
Yeah.
To get to work.
Yeah. They're the ones that are going to be standing at a bus stop.
Right.
And do you really think those buses are going to drive north into this and pick people up?
You mean south? North? Well, where are they coming
from?
They're
going to have to come north to get, because the buses are from Yonkers.
Oh, please.
So,
south of us.
It's a really good plan. And, you know, so far, everybody, all the politicians seem to stand by it. And, you know, when I call them on it, they say, well, you know, if we could replace the energy with something else, then we could close it down. I was like, well, that's just ridiculous.
We can replace it with turning off stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, what a concept.
You know, one of the things that always astounds me is no one ever says reduce your use. Reduce your use. It's not that hard to figure out. You know, we can use less. We don't have to keep using more and more.
Kind of back on consumption.
Let's make it more efficient so that I can use more.
But wait, if you do that, then you're going to cut money from the electric companies. So reduce doesn't work with capitalism.
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, so we go right back to the root of all evil is capitalism.
It's starting to seem that way.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I think it's... Really, I mean, that hearing that siren again and being there for all those people, that's like a low stress level every day. You feel that. You feel it in your gut. And if you're not feeling that, you're completely numb. Mm. Like, how can you not even, like, worry about that? It's on a fault line.
Right. Well, you know, what's really interesting that applies to that is the closer we got to Indian Point, the attitude of the interviewees was a little different.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I met this one group, gardening group, and they were just like, well, we're just going to go in our basement and have some wine. And then one other woman was like, you know, do you really have to be here even asking that question? She got a little defensive.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was another guy that thought he was going to go in the flash. Mm-hmm. And I think he confused a nuclear bomb with a nuclear power plant. Although now I think that could be a possibility now that they're putting in a 42-inch high-pressure flammable potentially explosive gas pipeline just 1,500 feet away. Clean, green, natural gas.
Oh, that's genius.
Isn't that brilliant?
Who came up with that?
That's
clever
the one under the Hudson.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And that's called the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion. It's a project of Spectra Energy in Texas. And we can thank Hillary Clinton for these sort of things because she's been traveling all over the world really paving the way for the offshore LNG plants.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So this pipeline is going through our county to head out to sea.
Right. People, don't be confused by Hillary. She is not a liberal. She is not a progressive. She is pro-hydrofracking. She is pro-war. And it's just astounding how people still think she's a Democrat. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, she's a Democrat, that's for sure.
She never met a war that she didn't like.
Exactly.
She loves war.
She voted for us to go into Iraq, so, yeah. And she's voting for us to hydrofrack. And we know what hydrofracking has done in Pennsylvania.
It's devastated it.
It's absolutely horrifying what it's done. Mm-hmm. So we don't want that up here.
And Texas and Wyoming. Texas. There's
34
states that have been fracked.
Yes.
New York is still holding out, but I'm afraid that after the election, Mr. Cuomo is just given the green light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I was flying quite a bit last year doing the documentary and I can see the fracking wells from the airplane and I took a lot of pictures. I mean, I don't know if I put any in the documentary, but it's sickening. It's like miles and miles and miles of wells just spread out like you know, like a plague. It's terrifying.
Right.
And it's going to all come through our little pipeline.
I know.
And we don't need, it's not even gas that we use.
No.
They're
going
to sell that to another country, maybe China.
But meanwhile, gas pipelines are the most dangerous type of pipeline. Back in 2010, out just south of San Francisco, the San Bruno pipeline exploded with 1,000-foot high flames, burned for 95 minutes, incinerated 38 houses, and killed 8 people. So that was a 30-inch pipeline. Yeah. I can't imagine what a 42-inch pipeline can do. And what really, talk about numb. You want to talk about numb? Why isn't every person in Westchester County saying, what the frack are you doing?
Yes.
And because the NRC is saying that they will investigate the safety of this is the only place in the entire United States where a gas pipeline is this close to a nuke plant.
That's insane.
And the NRC says we will wait till after the, once the pipeline's in, we will investigate.
It's almost like they want something to happen. There are 8 million people that live in Manhattan and work there.
Yeah.
And the surrounding area is the most populated region in the whole country. Yeah. What are these people thinking?
I know. Well, you know, the town of Lewisboro said, well, this really doesn't affect us.
Yes, I know. I know. My friend Dan Welsh was there. He's on the board, and he's trying to get his fellow board members to use their brain cells.
Right.
And it's not happening.
Well, and then you have the right-wing trolls that, you know, go on commentary.
They get paid.
Yeah, I think the Heritage Institute does.
Yes,
have
they
a
do. They
program.
Pay them. Yep.
We should get a job.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, I'm actually toying with this idea of making like the next little movie be this, you know, thing.
Troll
where,
Hunter?
No. Where I just want to demonstrate like pipeline, nuke plant. You know, go in the green room there and just do like big explosion. Just spell it out.
Well, remember when we were at that nuke presentation in the city,
right?
With you know, with
Ralph Nader and Arnie
Gunderson, and they showed that little video that
the
cinematographer.
Boat.
They sat in the Hudson River, just a few yards away from Indian Point, for hours, and no one came and asked them what they were doing.
Right. Yeah,
wow.
And then finally, somebody was like, "What you guys doing?" It's like I was shooting a documentary, and they were like, "Oh."
Yeah,
and I think they just left. It's like, so it's kind of scary, you know, how vulnerable that place
is. So imagine if you had a, you know, shoulder hoisted rocket launcher in your boat and you got the gas pipeline. It's like, duh.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Like, this is just, you know, a symptom
it doesn't
of our
take
insanity.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out.
No.
Yeah. So maybe we should run the country.
I do think that
the country might work out a little better if moms
if
were
moms
in charge.
Were in it,
because we are looking out for the next generation
Definitely.
And the generation after that. I don't know if Hillary is. Maybe when she becomes a grandma, she'll like think about her child's future. I don't know. But
she's got a bunker she can go to. She'll be fine.
Go.
She's immune.
Yeah. But yeah, I do wonder if we could just take over the world just for a few days. Like we could chill things out.
Yeah, that would be nice.
It would.
I think we could do a good job, actually. And it would be fun, you know, because right now it's not fun.
No,
it's not fun.
We've got wars breaking out, civil wars. We've got Ebola. We've got fires. We've got climate change, global warming. The ice caps are melting.
A corporate-controlled media that isn't reporting the ongoing protests in London, in Hong Kong, in Ferguson.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but money is still being made. You make money going up, and you make money on the way down.
Money is king.
Money is king in this kind of a
society
that we live in.
Exactly.
So I don't think there's any, at this point, you know, persuading or teaching the bigwigs that, you know, they're harming future generations. I just don't think that that's in their radar.
No, it's not.
The people that are in control right now and really calling the shots.
I wonder if they are even aware of the harm that they are doing.
You know, at this point, I've thought about that for years on and off with different topics. And at this point, I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
You know, It's like they're ruining everything.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a little piece of them in all of us. I think that that 1% right now that's really calling the shots, I think that they are, you know, our enemy.
Yes.
And I think that we have to realize that at some point the lines will be drawn, you know, and that this idea that we can just, you know, sit them down and have a good heart to heart with them and they'll change. I think that time has passed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not how we got the right to vote, ladies.
No.
We didn't just sit them down and have a heart to heart.
No, we actually tried that.
Yeah.
And
it didn't work.
It didn't work. And then so we stood in front of the White House. And they arrested us, and then we went on hunger strikes, and then they shoved food down their throats. And, you know, you have to really sacrifice, unfortunately. And even so, we barely won the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, you know, all the states said, hey, yeah, women should vote. What are we thinking?
Right.
No, it wasn't. It was a handful of states, and it was just barely enough. Just barely. So, and... The ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, has yet to be passed.
Hello.
Well, they just said today that they've just done a new study and they've found that women will not be making the same pay as men for the same job the way things are going right now until 2090.
Well, we're going to be long gone before that. We've got it. We've got it. The clock is counting down to 2030. Haven't you heard?
No, I know. Yeah.
But that's a long time to wait for my daughters.
Right.
And yours.
And that's just to be paid equal to what men are being paid. It's not like for any big advantage.
Exactly.
It's just for equality.
Well, you know, when I did my thesis, I did it on women in poverty. And women have to get higher degrees to make the same as a man who just went to high school. So I need a graduate level degree so that I can make the same that a guy is making because he graduated from high school. So, you know, if you're a garbage man, if you're a sanitation worker, you get everything. You get benefits. You get health care. You get just a beautiful retirement. It's a really dangerous job, granted. Yeah. But you're a high school graduate.
Right.
It didn't
really
cost
jobs.
You know, we went to college and it cost us $40,000, $60,000, however much we spent years of sacrificing work. I had to quit a job so that I could finish my graduate degree. I had to quit a teaching job to finish my teaching degree. I mean, and that job wasn't there when I was finished. So it's so unfair for us.
We were talking yesterday. I was at Pace College and about students that want to really make a change and do something different, like maybe become farmers in small farms and reinstitute small farms so that they can begin to supply the good food that we're talking about to Westchester County and New York City. First of all, these students are saddled with debt.
Yes.
And secondly, the land around here, anywhere that would be close enough to make a drive into New York City to sell produce, you know, the land is prohibitively expensive.
It's crazy.
So really, as a young farmer, what do you do if you have the training, you've gotten the education, and you're willing to make these sacrifices to grow good, solid food for everybody? Mm-hmm. It's impossible.
You move to Central America.
Yeah, it seems like it might be impossible in this country unless you go to some place out west where you might not have access to water.
Well, the Westchester Land Trust provides several parcels of land for young farmers.
Well, I believe that there's 7,000 acres altogether in the Westchester Land Trust, and I think at last count, 12 acres were being farmed out of the 7,000.
That's not a lot.
And those farmers are not making enough to live.
No,
they're
not.
Absolutely.
Well, they can't even live on
free
the
land.
With free land.
They're not. We know and love some of those farmers.
Yes, they're our dear friends. Absolutely.
Well, the only way they're making money is supplying to the restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
The high end.
Absolutely.
The farm to table restaurants.
High end restaurants that we can't afford.
Well, who can afford that food?
Right.
Can we compare again to Cuba?
Yeah.
Where they had the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had a monoculture in Cuba during when they had the support of the Soviet Union, you know, huge estates, fertilizers, pesticides, one crop, you know, way out in the country, no agriculture in the cities. So they've made an attempt now to get young people to move into the country to grow food. And what do? They provide the land to the farmers in usufruct, it's called, which means that you get to farm that land for as long as you want, as long as you're producing food. You pay no rent. If you want to build a house, they'll give you interest-free loans so that you can build your little house for your family. Wow. They provide you with your two oxen that you need.
That's great.
Because they don't have the resources for having tractors. Mm-hmm. They provide you the seeds, the farm implements that you need so that you can get started growing. All at low to no cost.
That's
and
fantastic.
So a lot of young couples now have taken advantage of that and moved out to the country and started farming. And now being a farm in Cuba is more of an esteemed profession.
Right.
Like it's becoming here among some young people.
Yeah.
The greenhorns.
The greenhorns. Yeah.
That's great. That's amazing. I think, I mean, why can't we do that?
And it's a lot of young people have and are moving further north. Where
they
there's
have to.
Affordable land.
They have to.
And they're profitable.
So let me do a station break. I'm Pauline Schneider. This is Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. I'm sitting here with Cameron Kelly and Susan Rubin, and we're having an amazing conversation. Susan.
Yeah.
The Reverend Billy.
Ah, yes.
We like him.
Let me tell you a little bit about the Reverend Billy and his Church of Stop Shopping. He started a long time ago here in New York as an anti-consumerist activist group preaching in Times Square. Mickey Mouse is the devil. And so he's moved along into other things, talking about banks that finance climate change. And dare I say he's on the same page as Dr. Guy McPherson. He wrote a book last year called The End of the World.
Huh.
And he speaks a lot and about what we're going to do and how are we going to take action. And what I love about the Reverend Billy and the church is that they have fun.
Yeah.
And they're really talented. They've got a lot of songs. If you go to revbilly.com, you'll see some of his Freak Storm sermons.
That's great.
He's going to be, they are going to be playing another string of shows at Joe's Pub starting the Sunday before Thanksgiving. Then from there, they're going to be spending Thanksgiving in Ferguson, Missouri. And from there, they're going to head over to Monsanto headquarters where they're going to take some wild amaranth and they're going to try to exorcise the evil that is Monsanto. Because right now, this year, the campaign is Honeybee-luya. And so the choir is all dressed up as honeybees and they sing songs about honeybees and they talk a lot about the neonicotinoid pesticides. They also went to Harvard University where they're now the Department of Defense is funding the Robo-Bee, which is a little bee drone. So good work. And they travel all over the country and all over the world. I would definitely, you know, if you want a little lighthearted activism and some fun and some food for your spirit, check out the revbilly.com.
He's great.
Yeah.
And it was fun to see him at the march.
Was that like the most fun chunk of that parade?
It was great.
They had drums and they were singing.
They looked beautiful. They were dressed as flowers and bees.
Yep.
And just, they were great. And he had just
gotten out of jail.
And he'd hurt his leg.
Right.
Because he'd been up in a tree.
Yes.
He'd been tree sitting a tree in Central Park or one of the parks nearby.
Down in the Lower East Side at the jump, what was it, the something tree. But yeah, it got cut down the day before at 8 in the morning. I don't know why the arborists were up at 8 in the morning chopping down
this. Was up there?
Yeah, he tried to stop it from being
murdered.
Destroyed. Yes.
And it was beautiful.
The Bendy tree.
The Bendy tree.
The Bendy
tree. It's beautiful.
So yeah, the Reverend's been arrested over 65 times. Last year, he was just gutsy enough to go into Chase Manhattan's lobby.
It's actually scary.
Yeah, up on 57th Street where the big money people, not just a regular bank lobby, he'd done a lot of those, but this one in a particular wealth management bank, when he was arrested for that one, they threatened to send him away for a year, but we rounded up a good petition and some support, so he got off with a day of rake and leaves.
That's so amazing.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to finish this up in just a couple seconds here, but I wanted to ask you very quickly. You did the two-row wampum. You rowed a canoe.
Kayak.
The kayak. Sorry. Cameron. Yeah. Cameron, you went down the Hudson River on this historic event, celebrating 400 years of this treaty between...
The first treaty ever signed between Native Americans, First Nation people, and the Dutch. The first treaty ever signed.
The first treaty broken as well?
First treaty signed and broken, yeah. Right. And the treaty basically said that the Haudenosaunee and the Dutch would go down the River of Life in two rows, neither altering each other's society or anything, living in peace and harmony. Mm-hmm. And they signed to that. And there are many, many treaties that have followed that between First Nations and the U.S. government since then. And I think that's one of the things now that a lot of Native peoples in this country and Canada are saying, look, we have these treaties. Mm-hmm. Let's look at these treaties and let's uphold these treaties. And if you want to a friend or an ally to First Nation people at this point, that's the thing that they are asking for us to do, is to look at these treaties and uphold these treaties that are the law of the land and are constitutional.
Mm-hmm. They are.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So they should be upheld.
They should be.
Yeah. And that might change a whole lot of things.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And they have, you know... It's just amazing to have watched them come riding down.
The canoes and kayaks, over 200 boats.
The kayaks, you're right, they came down, and then riding alongside them on the land were the chiefs with the young braves on horseback. And it was very emotional. I was very choked up watching this because, you know, we know the history over the last 400 years, what's happened and what's befallen this incredible... These people that whose land we're on right now.
Exactly. Yes.
It's a travesty.
Decolonize. Got to decolonize.
So very briefly, if any messages would you like to give out to people? We have 30 seconds.
You know, I'm for fun and everything, and I think it's all wonderful. Mm-hmm. But I think that push is going to come to shove at some point pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be talking about that and thinking about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be very happy for very much longer as things get worse.
Right.
So,
I'm gonna keep continuing my work with the revolution, and I'm gonna continue to pursue play and fun.
Well,
a la Russell Brand.
We'll be there with you.
Yeah.
We all are going to deal with this our separate ways. And there, as Guy always says, there are 7+ billion ways of handling this, you know, dealing with it. So I want to thank you to Susan, Ruben, and Cameron Kelly for showing up.
Thank you so much.
Really
our pleasure. Fantastic. Thanks for having us.
Wonderful.
And to everyone listening, if anyone's feeling isolated, you have no one to talk to, please join the Near Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. It's a really compassionate place that's dedicated to listening. We try not to judge, we just share. And also, if you're in Manhattan and looking for like-minded souls to share these ideas with in person, David Petratus is forming a support group there. His email for the support group is nyc@extinction.support. His website is www.extinction.support. Guy will return next week, and he'll be interviewing Carl Klein, professor and homesteader who lives off the grid in upstate New York, and he will be talking about the state of higher education in the U.S., which seems something of an oxymoron. So, let's see, there's one more thing I wanted to mention. I ran into David Petratus at the march, and it was amazing. I recognized him right away. He had his NTHE thing on, and instantly we recognized each other as soulmates. So it was a lot of fun. So remember, we all know that dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats back.